Blog Talk Radio.
Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and this is the broadcast for Thursday, April 29th. Tonight, we're going to present an ancient Canaanite epic entitled Prince Akkot and the Magic Bow. Now, this is taken from our book, Seasonal Rites of Baal and Astarte, which was published in 1998 and is still available from Amazon.com. And Prince Akkot and the Magic Bow is an ancient Canaanite epic, 3,500 years old. It was written down on clay tablets by the scribe Eli Melek, who was the scribe to King Nakhmamad of Ugarit. And this library of ancient Canaanite epics was not really discovered until the late 1930s and not translated and made available till the 1960s. And so finally, after all this time, we got a chance to find out what the ancient religions and the myths of the Canaanites were so important to Solomon's magic, and the mythology that's really behind the Bible. We finally got a chance to really find out what it was all about. And this is these clay tablets from Ugarit are what we based our seasonal ceremonies at the OTA on. Now, Canaanite myths are done in a style that doesn't adapt itself very well to modern reading. They use a triple metaphor style. Each element is described three times in three different ways, and so this makes it difficult to present this to a modern audience. So consequently, I rewrote and somewhat enhanced the tale of Prince Akkot and the Magic Bow, but we've tried to keep it as close to the original as possible. And we're going to do the first half of this story tonight, and then we will finish the story up next week. So that we'll get right into it. Now I want you to imagine, as I read, that you're going back in time, way back before Moses, before Solomon, back to the time of Melchizedek, back in ancient Canaan. Atop Mount Zaphon, under that star-strewn canopy of dark heaven, which is the pavilion of Father El and Mother Asherah of the sea, a grand tribunal was in session. Kothor Kasis, the craftsman of the gods, was on trial for having invented the chariot. Now, this innovation had thrown human conflicts out of balance by providing rich, ambitious warlords with irresistible weapons of conquest. Well, in his defense, Kothor pleaded that he'd given men the cartwheel and the wagon wheel, but not the bronze-shod and spike-up chariot wheel. He protested that, under the influence of the war goddess Anath, the good intention of his gift had been perverted, thus transforming warfare from noble contests between bronze-armored heroes into an impersonal bloody whirlwind of slaughter. Father El, the compassionate, gently reminded the clever Kothor that his earlier invention of writing had resulted in mankind's losing the necessity to memorize those things that were worth knowing, and ever since that advancement, people had had to relearn the same hard lessons over and over. Xataquat, the goddess of healing, agreed, and she agreed that chariots had made warfare a curse upon the land, and she pleaded with Father El to simply forbid armed conflicts among the peoples. Now El, the kindly god, recalled to her that men and women had been given free will and were masters of their own destiny. Oh, they must themselves slay Anath's birds of war, the eagles of pride, the hawks of hatred, the vultures of greed, and the ravens of guile that she sends to perch on their shoulders, the Allfather declared. Lady Asherat, eternal mother of all, nodded in solemn agreement. But we are not without responsibility. And we are not without influence. We reach down and touch them, lean down and whisper to them. And we can sire a hero to lead them from this darkness. Such a hero would need a very special weapon, Prince Baal declared. Kothor, the craftsman, saw in Baal's suggestion an opportunity to redeem himself. He straightway offered to fashion a mighty bow and magic arrows that would bring Anath's evil birds of prey down from the sky. But where will we find a hero fit for such a perilous venture? The queen asked. With Father El's blessing, I shall sire a son upon a mortal woman, and he shall have the soul of a man and the spirit of the gods, Prince Baal announced. Oh, I wonder what your sister Anath, our goddess of war, would say to such a plan if she were here, Father El pondered aloud. Oh, even as we speak, my darling sister Scranage, ankle-deep in blood over the plain of Megiddo, Baal replied. If she were not drunk with slaughter at this moment, we would hardly dare to discuss such a plan. Let us guard our tongues until the sprig I plant becomes a mighty tree. But in the darkness, behind El's eight-winged throne, a raven silently swooped down from his perch, glided out of the pavilion, and on through the night, winging its way southward. The last embers of sunset glowed blood-red over the plain of Megiddo, casting dim light on the ruin of a once-proud army. Through this silent litter of broken lances and scattered corpses, prowled looters, jackals, and softly weeping women. The only survivor of this defeated host was the priest king of the Raphaites of Bashan. And it was only by accident that he still lived. King Daniel lay sorely wounded and pinned under his overturned chariot. He could not get to his feet, but he was still strong enough to fight off the carrion birds that surrounded him. It was the screeching and the fluttering of these vultures that told the victorious Yatpan, war chief of the fierce Sukian tribesmen, that one of his enemies still had life in him. Yatpan looked down on Daniel and gloated over his misfortune. He drew his sword, and he was about to kill the stricken and immobilized king, when a sudden gust of wind arose. The pale first stars of night were blotted out by a giant eagle descending upon them. The outspread wings of Shumal, the mother of eagles, became the war cloak of the goddess Anath. She stood before them, armed and armored. "Stay your hand, Yat-Pan," she ordered. "This Daniel is beloved of my brother, Prince Baal." She looked down upon the king. "Daniel, why did you dare to take arms against my champion? Surely you must know that Yat-Pan rides under my Red Skull standard." "I answered the call of a friend," Daniel said.
"Now he and all his host, along with all your levies, are food for the vultures. Is there a lesson in this?"
"What I did, I would do again," he replied. Anath laughed.
"You lean too much on my brother's favor. You know I must not cause your death. But I vow to take the life from you nonetheless."
And so saying, she kicked the chariot away with her toe, as if it had been no more than a twig.
"Get up, Daniel. Limp home. Nurse your wounds and ponder the fruits of your folly."
Daniel returned to his palace in Hornam, near the eastern shore of the Sea of Kinnereth, which we know as the Sea of Galilee. While he lay about recovering from his injuries, Anath's threat continued to trouble him. Would he regain his strength? Could he once again lead men in battle?
Could Osiris, the son he so desired, to carry on his line, venerate their divine ancestors, and give him joy in his old age?
By the coming of summer, his strength did return, along with his virility. Anath's curse was all but forgotten. Daniel had decided to concentrate his manly energies upon souring a son in a magical hero's gamos, a rite in the weeks before the longest day of the year, so that the lad dedicated to Baal would be conceived in the fullness of the Cloud Rider's power. Daniel knew that Baal, following his yearly summer solstice battle with the Dark Lord Mote, would lay dormant in the caverns of the underworld until revived at autumn equinox. When King Daniel confided his amorous intention to Queen Donatae, she was outwardly pleased at the prospect, but in her secret heart she was uneasy with the ritual aspects. She had given birth to their first child, a daughter, just before her husband had gone off a-warring, and during his absence, and while his wounds were healing, they had not lain with each other, and she was now uncertain that their long-suppressed desires alone would be enough to ensure the insemination of a male child. They would certainly need strong magic. Daniel was intent on a ritual congress in which he would take the role of Baal, and she would wear the eagle mask of Anath. And yet, Anath was now the sworn enemy of their house. Queen Donatae's patron deities were Prince Yarik, the moon god, and his heavenly bride, the Lady Nakal, daughter of the sea god Dagon. She planned to personally dedicate herself to Nakal while wearing Anath's costume. Keeping this idea to herself, she asked her husband to summon the Kotharat, virgin brides of the moon, to be with her during the time of conception. King Daniel, knowing the mysterious powers of the lunar cult in matters of feminine fertility, agreed. He sent messengers riding northward to Court Ablim, the City of Sorrows, bearing gifts and inviting the swallow-like daughters of the crescent moon to attend his queen. The silent, black-robed and veiled women came with silver bells on their ankles and silver zills on their fingertips, Daniel feasted them each day, and they danced and sang for 6 nights. They danced the dance of courtship, the dance of marriage, the dance of mating, the dance of conception, and the dance of birth, and the dance of destiny. And they sang a song for each dance, but not a word would they speak to anyone. On the seventh night, in her chambers, Queen Danate hummed the song of mating, as she carefully prepared for the coming rite of love. The silent, night-veiled moon maidens had bathed, oiled, and perfumed the queen. Smooth as alabaster was Danate's skin, and soft as rose petals were her cheeks. Sacred symbols and magical formulas had been painted on her breasts and belly. An unguent of honey, pomegranate juice, and secret herbs had been massaged deep into her nether lips. She was robed in the sheerest of Egyptian linen, through which her enticing charms could be glimpsed as if through a veil of morning mist, enhanced with adornments of carnelian and lapis lazuli, set in richest gold. Meanwhile, King Daniel himself, regally prepared, awaited his queen and priestess in the flower-decked sacred bower of their rooftop temple. At the muffled sound of a gong, one of the veiled moon maidens placed a powerful blend of enchanting incense on the braziers and then quietly withdrew. Daniel's consort entered in silent splendor, her face half hidden behind the golden eagle mask of Anath. She let fall her purple cape, loosed the girdle of golden hands at her waist, and came to Daniel's couch. Moist lips touched his, soft arms embraced him. She caressed his loins and found him ready. And as he entered her body, he breathlessly whispered the litany of the sacred marriage rite. With this golden gift I wed thee, with this draught I plant my spark. The floodgate of his passion opened within her. Nurture deep the dew of sunfire in thy vast and vital dark, he gasped as his seed rushed forth to fill her womb. But as soon as he was spent, she roughly pushed him away. With a mirthless laugh of triumph, she ripped off the mask, revealing the blazing eyes of the warrior goddess herself. Daniel fell back, dazed, depleted, paralyzed in shock. He was like an old man, powerless and aching in every bone. Now, Daniel, live out your life and count the empty years, Anath said. She donned her cloak with a swirling motion, transformed herself into the giant she-eagle, and with an explosive beating of her great wings, she sprang up and away into the starry night. As he lay dazed and trembling on the nuptial couch, Daniel tried to convince himself that it had been an evil dream brought on by the narcotic fumes of temple incense, for that's how they used the kiff in those days. With a tinkle of silver bells, Queen Danate herself entered and came to him. She too kissed and embraced him. And though her lips tasted of honey and her hair smelled of jasmine, he did not respond. And when she pressed his loins, he showed no sign of desire. King Daniel had been completely and utterly unmanned. In a hoarse, halting voice, he tried to explain what had happened. Danate found his story difficult to believe. She was stricken with a deep sadness. I am sorry that my poor earthly charms are not the equal of your dreams, my lord, she murmured, weeping softly. She rose to leave, but with her movement, the bedclothes fell away. And she gasped in surprise as an eagle feather nearly 2 cubits in length fell at her feet. Forgive me for doubting you, she declared. We are indeed cursed. With only 10 days remaining until summer solstice, Daniel grimly rededicated himself to Baal in a 7-day fast. And during this vigil, he stayed alone in the rooftop temple, offering up sacrifices and prayers in the hope of lifting Anath's curse. And finally, on the night of the seventh day, Baal's image appeared to Daniel in a laver of water. Vanate will indeed bear a son, the god whispered. I will see to that. And just before dawn, in the royal bedchamber below, Queen Danate was brought back from her dreams by a touch on her shoulder. She opened her sleepy eyes to behold a bearded face half hidden behind the golden ceremonial mask of Baal. Daniel's wife smiled and held out her arms to welcome her lord. She was eager to yield, but instead of the familiar caresses she expected, larger, stronger hands explored her body. Intoxicating fire flowed through her veins at his touch. She opened to his thrust like a blooming flower once, twice, thrice. She was deeply invaded until the seed was cast within her. Danate gasped in awe. My lord, you have become a stallion. He laughed. I've always been a stallion. And so saying, he doffed the ritual mask, showing her his flashing eyes, his horns, and a nimbus of glory about his head. The son born of this our union shall be an instrument of the gods. Take comfort in that, for his life will be short, Prince Baal told the amazed queen. Having accomplished his purpose, the cloud rider clapped his hands and vanished in a flash of lightning and a roll of thunder. The next morning, the Kothirat silently made ready to depart. When the sisters were all mounted on their donkeys and their high priestess was seated in her sedan chair, the great lady lowered her veil and spoke to Queen Danate and King Daniel for the first and last time. A male child will be born to you, a plaything of the gods, but his heart is with the moon, and he will come to us one day. Danate was soon with child, but she concealed the truth of its patrimony and Baal's dire prediction from her husband. She hoped that ignorance of his true parentage might keep her son from following his destiny in this meeting in early doom. In keeping with his divine origin, the Prince Akkad of Bashan was born upon the very day of vernal equinox, on the occasion of the new year and the annual sacred marriage rite. King Daniel officiated at his son's formal dedication to Baal Hadad, whose warm sun and gentle rains yearly germinated the fertile fields. And for this was the future king's traditional responsibility to the land he would rule. The lad grew to early manhood straight and tall, in a time of peace and plenty, and he was the joy and the pride of his indulgent parents. Only his older sister attempted to restrain him with prudent advice, which he always lightheartedly ignored. Akkad grew up headstrong and willful, even for a crown prince, in the proud lineage of the Raphaim, who were descended from that mighty race of giants who had ruled Canaan before the great flood. In Akkad's 17th year, on a hot, sunbright day preceding the young man's birthday, King Daniel was seated under his awning just inside Harnam's city gate, dispensing justice to his people. He had spent half the morning adjusting creditors' claims against the recent widow's estate so that she might have a dowry to marry again, and he was in the process of arranging an apprenticeship for the orphan son of one of his deceased soldiers when he heard a cry of alarm from the lookout on the parapet of the barbican. Daniel adjourned his court and climbed aloft to see for himself what the commotion was all about. A ship seemed to be approaching, not from seaward, but rather over the broad, dry plain to the north, sailing toward them just above the shimmering mirage on the horizon. At first, King Daniel supposed that it was just that, a reflection from the Sea of Kinnereth. But as the purple-sailed vessel drew closer, the king was forced to accept the reality of an ingenious craft that was part boat and part wagon. At the head helm stood a dark-bearded giant dressed in the scorched leather of a blacksmith. He was none other than Kothor, the craftsman of Mount Zaphon. With the skill of a master mariner, he brought his sailing wagon around, luffing the sheets to stop just outside the city gate. King Daniel, young Prince Akkad, and all of their retainers came forth and fell on their knees before the god of invention and progress. "You honor our house, great Kothor," Daniel declared, "and your landship is a marvel." "But how do you sail over rocky ground?" Akkad asked, still kneeling. "A question well asked. Actually, I've devised a way to make it fly. But people are not ready for that yet," the god replied. "My heavenly colleagues don't even think people are ready for the wheel," he added under his breath. "And you must be the lad Akkad." "Yeah," Kothar said, and he motioned for the young man to rise. Akkad stood up to his full height and looked the god square in the eye without blinking. Kothar smiled as he took measure of the young prince. "You'll do very well. Now, Daniel, before I join your family at table, you and I have matters to discuss in private." When the king and the god were alone in the rooftop temple, Kothar informed Daniel of Akkad's singular patrimony and his heroic destiny. Daniel was gripped by a mix of conflicting emotions. Was he to lose his only male heir? Who would assume the continuance of his line? Without a strong young prince ready to take the throne, the kingdom of Bashan would be ravaged and sundered. When Daniel grew old and enfeebled, but the king was awed by the discovery that his son would dwell with the gods in song and story down through the ages. Kothar put a strong hand on Daniel's shoulder. "We must tame this heavenly pitch of war, or humankind is doomed to rut and slaughter like the beasts for all eternity. Having suffered her wrath, you, above all men, should know this, Daniel. Well, would you give my son your blessing, your counsel?" "My blessing, yes. But he must not know of his origin or the nature of his quest. He must go forth as an innocent, armed with the magic bow and arrows I shall give him tomorrow on his birthday." "The moth will destroy him," Daniel protested. "Oh, perhaps, but in so doing, she will come to the end of her evil power." Kothar would explain no more. He and Daniel went down to the feast, where the god became delightfully drunk and entertained them all with magic tricks and a ribald story about Father El's romantic liaison with two wenches on the seashore, whom El had seduced by roasting a pheasant for them. On the next day, after the fertility dance, in which the celebrants wound colored ribbons around the Asherah pole, followed by the solemn ceremony of the sacred meal, Kothar ascended the dais and brought forth from his cloak a magnificent laminated bow of ash, horn, and sinew, together with a fine quiver of five arrows. Each bronze-tipped shaft was fletched with feathers of a different color. "This bow and these arrows are my birthday gift to you, Prince Akkad," the god declared. "But with them, I charge you to hunt only the creatures of the air and only the meat-eaters among them. I thank you with all my heart for this wondrous gift, divinity," said Akkad. "But what is this strange injunction you impose? Eagles, hawks, ravens, and vultures are not good to eat." "Well, as a huntsman for the gods, your task shall be to thin the ranks of these birds of prey so that the plump fowl and lovely songbirds will prosper in the land. That is Father El's pleasure and Mother Asherah's desire," Kothar replied, and he would say no more on the subject. The very next morning, Akkad was anxious to set forth on his first hunt with his new bow and arrows. But he was detained by his protective older sister, Pugat,
The lovely maiden could read the stars and had the gift of second sight. She adored her impetuous brother, and in spite of her interferences, there was a strong bond between them. And even though no one had revealed the secret of Akkad's dark destiny to her, Phugat knew that her sibling was in grave danger.
"You must not hunt these birds, darling brother. The gods are using you in a game you cannot win."
"Oh, I must. I gave Kothor the craftsman my word."
"Kothor the crafty one would be a better name for it. Don't you realize that he is sending you out to offend Anath? All of these birds you are to kill are sacred to her, and she will be insulted and enraged."
Akkad only smiled. "Well, then I shall offer the slain birds and pray to her brother, Prince Paul, and he'll keep her in her place. Now the sun is up and I must be off. Fear not, dear sister. It has been said that Anath has no power over those who resist her charms." And so saying, he took up his bow and quiver, mounted his chariot, and galloped off into the bright spring morning.
By noon, Akkad had bagged a number of the various meat-devouring birds, all on the wing as a sportsman should. His game sack was stuffed with hawks, ravens, and even a vulture, but he had yet to drop an eagle. There would be time for that after he had sacrificed his morning bag to Prince Al-Haddad, but before performing that duty, he had decided to find a shady spot and have lunch. The prince had developed a ferocious appetite, and he was not accustomed to denying himself anything in the service of gods or men. The son of King Daniel reined in his team, stopped under the spreading branches of a great oak tree. He dismounted with his knapsack and his wineskin and sat down on a boulder and fell to a hearty meal of bread, cheese, and salted beef. Hardly had he swallowed his first mouthful than he heard a screech from high in the branches. He looked up into the blazing noonday sun to see the silhouette of a huge eagle, for eagles had wingspans of 5 cubits in those days, perched above him. Silently and carefully, he put down his wineskin, slowly reached for his bow, which was still strung taut and ready, and from the quiver he drew out the purple-fledged arrow that had the magic to slay such a mighty lord of the skies, and swinging his bow up and drawing the string back to his cheek in one fluid motion, he prepared to loose at this monarch of the eagles. But the sun was suddenly blinding in his eyes. There was a great flapping of mighty wings. He hesitated for an instant, and the creature was gone. Or was it? A vibrant, powerful woman's voice from behind him asked, "Why do you hunt my birds of prey, Prince Akkad?" The prince looked back over his shoulder to see a lady like no other under the sun. She was taller than a noble warrior, strong-limbed and deep-breasted. Her bronze armor was adorned with a forlorn necklace of human heads and a grisly girdle of severed hands, a purple cloak with a glittering inner lining proclaiming her royalty, and an eagle-beaked helmet identified her as the war goddess Anath, even though it masked her features. "I have been gifted with this bow and so instructed by the god Kothor, divinity," Akkad replied with a respectful lowering of his head, but he was silently cursing himself for letting his physical hunger postpone the burnt offering of his game to Baal, thereby securing the patron god's protection. "Kothor is an artisan who serves those of higher rank," the goddess informed him. "If this bow was not intended for me, it certainly should have been. You may still find favor in my eyes if you give it over to me," Anath said, and Akkad sat motionless. Anath raised the beaked faceplate of her helmet, revealing her beautiful features and the terrible gleam in her bright eyes. "Hand it over. Now," she repeated her demand. Akkad
could not meet her awful stare. No mortal could.
Still, he would not relinquish the bow. In the moment of silence that followed, Anath focused more and more of her fierce energy upon him.
Akkad felt his strength ebbing away, his manhood departing, his mind clouding over, his very sense of identity drifting away, but still he held fast to the bow.
Finally, Anath was forced to realize that she could rob his arms of their power, his loins of their virility, and even his mind of his faculties, but she could not conquer the honor that lived in his heart. She vented a sigh of resignation and decided on a different approach. She took off her helmet, cast it away, shaking loose a mane of fiery red hair that shimmered in the sunlight. She drew her cloak close about her for a moment, then opened it, revealing her voluptuous, enticing form, scented, painted, and naked, except for the traditional adornment, the necklace of heads and the girdle of hands. She sat down beside a cot on the boulder and pressed her hip against his. Her lips were moist and her eyes heavy-lidded as she whispered, "For this bow, I would trade you your weight in silver and gold." Then she put her hand on his thigh, an unspoken offer of further reward.
"Save your silver and gold, great lady. Why not gather ash wood from Lebanon, sinews from a wild ox, the horns of a mountain goat, the tendons from the hocks of a bull, and a bundle of fine straight reeds from which Kuthor could then fashion you a bow even finer than this one," he replied.
To answer this argument would have revealed Anath's purpose, so she ignored it.
"I could grant you immortality. You would count your years with Baal, with the sons of El. You would count the seasons," she declared. To Akkad, who did not know of his own divine patrimony, this seemed an extraordinary, even an impossible offer.
However, Anath, having been informed of the young prince's heavenly lineage by her spying raven, knew that when his dead flesh and bones were finally buried in the earth, she would then be compelled to raise him again, even as she was obliged to revive his father, Prince Baal, each year at autumn equinox. Therefore, she was offering him something he already had, but he was not yet aware of it. Akkad, in the wisdom of his innocence, looked at the gruesome necklace of bloody heads that hung down toward her waist. An ironic smile crossed his face.
"Do not lie to me, divinity. You wear my future around your neck. All men must die. The best I can hope for is that my skull will one day sit painted and jeweled in a niche, honored and remembered by my descendants, or perhaps made into a drinking cup to be filled with honey liquor and passed around at high summer."
"Yes, indeed, all men must die," she admitted. "But I will resurrect you in autumn, even as I yearly renew the life of my brother, Prince Baal. You dare not doubt my power to grant this boon. You have only to give me the bow." With a flash of cleverness beyond his years, Akkad answered, "Then Prince Baal and I would be rivals. I have no desire to challenge him as the yearly life bringer to our fields. But if I had to fight him, I would certainly need my bow." Seething with frustration, Anath leaped to her feet. "Give me the bow," she demanded. Akkad looked at her womanly nakedness, whiffed her provocative scent, and replied, "What need does a woman so beautiful and so charming have for such a brutal weapon?" The very breath of her rage blew him off his seat on the rock and threw him to the ground. He looked up at her, standing over him once again, fully armed and armored. "Be warned, Prince Akkad. If ever you give way to lust or succumb to pride, I shall crush you like a beetle under my heel. And so saying, she spread her cloak wide, transformed herself into Shumal, the mother of eagles, and sprang up into the bright sky.
Akkad recovered himself. He set aside his unfinished meal and gathered stones to raise an altar for his belated sacrifice to Baal. And when he had the cairn completed and the fire laid, he emptied out his game bag to discover that instead of the birds he had killed that morning, the sack now contained only a coiled serpent that sprang at him with venomous fangs extended. The reptile narrowly missed biting the prince's good right arm. Akkad leaped back and seized a dart from the scabbard at the side of his chariot to slay the viper, but the creature escaped under the pile of stones he'd erected. Akkad kicked his owner apart and uncovered the snake, but it had disappeared. He saw the hand of Anath in this. The prince sat down with his head in his hands to sadly contemplate the cost of his selfish appetite and the folly of his pride against the gods. Meanwhile, Anath, in the form of Shumal, the mighty she-eagle, had flown straightway to Mount Zaphon, source of the four rivers which irrigate the world, and even to the star-canopied tent of Father El the Compassionate and Mother Asherat of the Sea. Did the warrior maiden ascend even to Mount Zaphon? And there she presented herself before the eight-winged throne of the universe and demanded heavenly retribution for the insult she claimed to have suffered. Bol-El, kindly emperor of heaven and earth, and all the stars beyond, listened to her petition carefully, and then he replied, "We gave our blessing to your brother Prince Baal when he sired the lad Akkad upon the mortal woman Denate. Akkad is therefore of our family, and we shall not raise our hand against him." Anath, though enraged, did not allow fury to overcome guile. She pretended surprise upon hearing of Akkad's divine origin in order to add righteous indignation to her complaint. "What treachery is this? Have you all conspired against me?" Queen Mother Asherat tried to calm the furious war goddess. "We love you, daughter, and we never intended to bring shame upon you. But the people cry out for relief from the terrible wars that you bring upon them. Your birds of prey spread this plague of violence all throughout the land. It is fitting that their number be diminished." "And that I be made to play the fool in the process? I think not. I demand justice as my right. Strike down my brother's arrogant little bastard and deliver that magic bow to me. And if you refuse me in this, I shall raise all the nations in such a war that will make you tear your hair, gnash your breasts, and weep a bottomless ocean of tears, I promise you." In that moment, Father El Latapan looked older than the span of eternity, sadder than all the bereaved who ever wept, for he felt fears and the miseries of his human children upon the earth, and he regretted not always being able to save them from their follies and their excesses. This conflict between Anath and her nephew, the hero Akkad, was a case in which he could not act directly, because the issues were so strongly entwined with the choice of destiny and freedom of will that he had given to the human race. The Lord of the universe would have to stand clear and let this drama play out. "We will take no part in this quarrel. We will not condemn the hero Akkad, son of Baal-Hadad, nor will we place any restraint upon you. Go forth and do what is in your heart, my daughter. No one will stay your hand." Anath trembled in pent-up anger. Father El had called Akkad a hero and had named him son of Baal. while giving her permission to commit a terrible crime. The father of the gods had laid a trap she dared not step into. She bit her lip and smoldered in silence as a devious plan grew in her mind. Then at length she said, "Anath will not kill your little darling. Akkad's precious blood will not be spilled in Daniel's house or in the furrows of his fields. But I will have justice. Be assured of that." In King Daniel's palace at Renam, in the dark, silent night, Prince Akkad was caught in the spell of a strange, erotic dream. He lay motionless as a pale, voluptuous young woman with lustrous dark hair and a face as round as the moon leaned down over him and kissed his lips. Her breath was sweet and warm on his cheek. She smelled of jasmine, and the little silver bells that hung from her sheer gown made music when she moved. She touched his loins with cool fingers, kindling a fire of lust within him. "Would you have me for your lover, my prince?" she whispered. He could not speak. He could not move. Only his manhood responded under her fingers. She smiled, taking this for her answer. "Then you must ask quickly, for I am to become a bride of Yarik, one of the ever-chaste Kugarat, on the first full moon after summer solstice. The only time that you could hope to spirit me away would be during the dark of the moon 3 days hence. You must set forth at once on your journey. Make your way north in all haste to the city of Arbalin, where stands the Tower of the Moon, and there I shall be waiting." Akkad suddenly cried aloud and sprang up from his couch. The memory of the dream was vivid in his mind. He was burning with lust. To steal a virgin dedicated to the moon god was an evil act that no god or man would condone. But he was determined to have this maiden of the starry veils, this lady of the silver bells. As Akkad was contemplating his dream quest, 100 leagues to the southwest, on the plain of Sharon, Yatvan, warlord of the fierce Sutean tribesmen, was roaring drunk. The bronze scythe blades fixed to the hubs of his chariot wheels still dripped with the blood of the rebellious villagers who had dared to refuse him tribute. He sat sprawled in his tent, amid the pitiful treasures looted from his victims, while his red-veiled minions dragged the captured maidens of the burned-out villages before him and stripped them naked for his inspection. "If I find no virgin among them, then bring me the boys," he shouted, and his men laughed at their commander's crude joke, which was hardly a joke given Lotpon's voracious appetites. The warlord finally selected a doe-eyed maid, not yet 12 years of age, to deflower. He waved the rest of them out of his tent, and he pulled the frightened child into his crushing embrace. But then, a marvelous thing happened. His perched hunting falcon suddenly began to grow. The bird's beak burst forth from its hood, and the creature spread its wings 4, 5, and then 7 cubits wide from tip to tip. The hawk's outspread wings became the shimmering lining of Anath's great cloak. Yatvan stared in open-mouthed wonder at his divine mistress standing before him. But the captured girl screamed in terror. The goddess glanced down at the trembling child and then turned her cruel gaze upon Yatvan. "My visit and our discussion must be kept secret." Yatvan nodded, quickly drew a razor-sharp bronze dagger, seized the girl by the hair, slit her throat from ear to ear as casually as he would have slaughtered a goat. "Now you may speak your mind, divinity," he said, pushing the dying maiden's bleeding body off of an expensive Babylonian rug with his foot. Briefly, Anath related the details of her encounter with Akkad and his refusal to relinquish the magic bow. She was careful not to tell her mortal champion about the young prince's divine parentage or of the concern for his welfare among the Holy Family on Mount Zaphon. The villainous Yat Pon, like his heroic counterpart, Akkad, would not be permitted to know the stakes of the game he played, for such was always the way of the gods when they used mortals to accomplish their mysterious designs. And there we will interrupt our tale to be finished at our next session. And in order to make sure we can get the next segment all done on the next session, we weren't able to take any calls this evening, so I apologize for that, but I do think you want to hear the whole story. So, as I said, this story is in Seasonal Rites of Baal and Astarte, which you can order from Amazon.com. And I hope you've enjoyed this session of the Hermetic Hour.